It's going to affect the supply chains and a lot of the new machinery that is essential for, let's say, the cars that Elon Musk wants to build and so on. So, in fact, this is also going to come back to bite the United States.
And the U.S. ultimately putting tariffs on China of over 50% and then China retaliating with over 30% tariffs in this last minute.
I think what's really significant about the Chinese response is not just the tariff response, but the fact that they have put export bans on some critical raw materials of which they are currently the only global producer. And that's going to affect all kinds of production, all of the new high technology production that the US wants to encourage, and where it feels that it wants to gain a technological advantage over China, simply won't happen. Everything from EVs to solar panels to you name it, defense equipment, etc., all of this is going to be affected. So it's been a remarkably stupid strategic move by Trump.
Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say that there's a silver lining in this for developing countries, which is that for too long, for maybe three decades, we've been told that the only way we can develop is through export-led growth. And that's really, it's been unfortunate because we have never seen giving our own workers a fair deal as a good option. We've always seen wages as a cost, not as a source of our own domestic demand and market. It's now time to actually change, to shift gears, to think about different trading arrangements, more regional arrangements, looking at other developing countries as markets, looking at our own population as markets, and thinking about the things we can do to create sustainable production that's not ecologically damaging, that actually provides living wages and decent working conditions within our own countries.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much. University of Massachusetts Amherst Professor Jayati Ghosh, speaking to us from New Delhi. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April, you'll hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our fantastic programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to check out our specials, go to kboo.fm/AT.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the nonprofit Urban League of Portland, presenting its job fair Tuesday, April 8th from 11 to 3 at the Crown Plaza. The event will include career coaches and small and large businesses. More info at ulpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, thousands of Oregonians join hands-off rallies against President Trump and Elon Musk.
A University of Oregon student has their student visa unexpectedly revoked.
And in national news, today is Asian American Pacific Islander Women's Equal Pay Day.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 7th, 2025. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Lexis Ponce. Thousands of Oregonians rallied Saturday as part of a national hands-off protest against President Trump and Elon Musk. Rallies across the Portland area converged on the downtown waterfront around noon. The turnout was far higher than organizers were originally planning for, with their speakers not reaching the full crowd. Protesters demanded that the Trump administration and advisor Elon Musk take their hands off education, federal workers, trans people, and immigrants. Portland City Councilors Angelita Murillo, Tiffany Koyama Lane, and Samira Canal spoke at the rally. Canal told the crowd, quote, "Local government must be a firewall against the threat posed by the Trump administration, by austerity and by fascism. I ask you to give us not only your hope, but your passion and participation. Come to protests like this, help build the movement, and make good trouble," end quote. People who attended the rally had an array of different beliefs, but had a common disdain for Trump's administration. Homemade signs indicated shared concerns for the health care, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and Trump violating the Constitution. Here are some of the chants from the large rally in Portland.
The Portland rally turned into a march crossing the Morrison and Burnside bridges. Oregonians mobilized in 29 rallies across the state, including in smaller towns. In Madras, over 100 people rallied for Hands Off. At a large rally in Beaverton, Oregon, U.S. Representative Suzanne Bonamici spoke. Here's an excerpt of her remarks.
I'm so grateful to be here. Go back to Washington, D.C. on Monday, and I'm taking your energy with me to the fight. And I have to say, this is happening not just here in Beaverton. I was in Hillsborough this morning, but it's happening all across the country. Because we are sending a message to Donald Trump and Elon Musk and the Doge Musketeers. That hands off, right? Keep your tiny hands off of our democracy. They're back there cutting. They're laying off federal employees. Keep your hands off the federal employees that are doing great work. Keep your hands off of the Department of Education. Does anybody in this crowd think that Donald Trump or Elon Musk have ever set foot in a public school? No. They don't know what public schools do for our community, for our society, for democracy. They have no clue, and that's why they think it's just okay to get rid of the Department of Education. We say hands off the Department of Education. And I got a message for you, Donald Trump. You can't abolish the Department of Education. Yeah. Congress created the Department of Education. Only Congress could get rid of it. And we say no. Hands off the Department of Education. I don't even think they know what the Department of Education does, right? They probably don't even know how to spell it. They don't know what it does because they think they're going to get rid of whatever woke curriculum it is. Curriculum's up to the states, right? What the Department of Education does is help close opportunity gaps. It's about civil rights. That's where the education laws came from, the civil rights movement. Title I that helps low-income students, right? I've been an education advocate for decades. No one has ever said to me, we need less funding for students with disabilities. It's always fully fund the IDEA, right? But importantly, most importantly, the largest chunk of money, it's all important, but the largest piece of money that comes from the federal government is for Pell Grants, work study, and student loans to open the doors of higher education for everyone in this country. I would not be where I am today without the Pell Grants and student loans and work study that I use to get through community college, and law school. It's about equalizing opportunity, and they want to close those doors. Now they're going after libraries and museums. Unbelievable. We say no. Hands off. Hands off our libraries. Hands off our museums. And I'll tell you, when I did a town hall meeting in Hillsborough recently at Century High School with hundreds of people, some of you might have been there. After the town hall meeting, a fourth grader gave me a note. She handwrote this note on lined paper. And she said, I'm afraid. I'm afraid in school that ICE is going to come into my school and take my friends. I'm afraid that when I'm on the bus going home, ICE is going to get on the bus. And I'm afraid for my friends when they get home that their parents won't be there. That is a message from a fourth grader. And I say to Donald Trump and Elon Musk and his whole deportation mission, hands off of our immigrant community.
That was Oregon U.S. Representative Suzanne Bonamici speaking to the hands-off rally in Beaverton on Saturday. There were some 1,200 similar rallies across the country on Saturday, including in every major city in the United States.
A student at the University of Oregon had their visa revoked by Homeland Security due to unspecified criminal charges on March 28th. The university emphasized that they were not informed in advance and haven't gotten any details about the reason why the student's visa was canceled. A spokesperson confirmed that the university is required to inform students when their F1 visa status is terminated, and students are given 15 days to leave the country unless they have another legal way to stay. The university said, "We are working to understand more about the situation and are committed to handling this matter with care and respect for the student's privacy. When a student's visa is revoked, the university offers any assistance we can to provide." In the past, when a student's visa was revoked, the student was typically allowed to remain in the U.S. as long as they continued their studies. In this case, the student not only lost their visa, but their residency as well, meaning they have 2 weeks to leave the country. President Donald Trump's crackdown on immigration has other non-citizen students facing threats. This includes students who participated in pro-Palestine protests on college campuses. The Trump administration has cited a seldom-used statute allowing the removal of non-citizens if their presence threatens U.S. foreign policies. This has led to deportations, arrests, and some students leaving the country upon finding out their visas have been revoked.
Advocates fighting hunger in Oregon say the U.S. Department of Agriculture's cuts to local food programs will worsen hunger and harm local farmers amid rising food costs. KABU reporter Onyx has more on the story.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is cutting two federal programs that provide over $1 billion annually to support schools and food banks in purchasing local food. Groups working to end hunger in Oregon say these cuts will harm small farmers, school children, and some of the state's most vulnerable residents. Sarah Weber Ogden with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon says both programs are very popular. With 1 in 6 Oregon children facing food insecurities combined with rising food prices, she says these cuts could not come at a worse time.
These programs feed hungry folks in our communities. They support local growers and producers. And so this decision represents cruelty from my perspective.
Oregon Food Bank says it was expecting to receive about 90 truckloads of food this year from the USDA through the Local Food Purchase Assistance Program. But this order has been canceled. The organization reported a record number of visits last year, nearly a third more than the previous year. Oregon's local food producers were expecting more than $12 million in federal funding over the next 3 years through the Local Food for Schools program. Patrick Rowley fishes out the Winchester's Bay, Oregon, and supplies tuna to 6 school districts across the state. He says when he sells his fish locally rather than shipped overseas, Oregon processors, packers, and shippers benefit as well.
And then the ultimate value is when the students get the chance to eat the finest quality products the planet has to offer.
Rowley says he is hopeful that the Trump administration, which says the cuts are part of making the USDA more efficient, will decide to reinstate the program. Ogden says Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon and others have asked the state to help fill in the gaps from the lost federal funding, but it is not clear yet what is available. For KABU News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Onyx.
White House economic plans dominate the headlines, but actions on elections and voting rules are sparking debate. Local groups voice concerns about the future of immigration, healthcare, and nutrition. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm very concerned with the folks who stayed home. Donald Trump has identified their angst. They can't buy a house. They can't afford to get a good education. Their economic future is so precarious, it could slip out from under them. It should have been a slam dunk for us to say, we're the party that cares about that.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says many Americans aren't yet convinced Democrats would better serve their economic needs, even knowing what President Donald Trump's plans are. Commenting on their loss in November, Vice President Kamala Harris specifically told a meeting in California, "I'm not going to say I told you so," in spite of negative reactions to Trump's sweeping tariffs. Even after last week's sharp declines, stock futures again fell over the weekend. The League of Women Voters of Arizona is joining those suing over a new Trump executive order. Election law is set by the states, but the order bypasses them and Congress to require in-person federal proof of citizenship, not just a driver's license to vote. Penny Sheeran with the League says only about half of Americans have a passport, and requiring one puts democracy at risk, especially for states with large immigrant populations or rural areas where getting documents is hard.
Even the state serving as a buttress against, you know, the breaking of democracy is greatly under threat in Arizona specifically.
The White House defends the order as a common sense move to strengthen election security. Last month, the administration halted legal aid funding for the 25,000 unaccompanied migrant minors. Catherine Miller-Wilson with the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society in Pennsylvania says many of the 600 migrant children there were fleeing violence or persecution. Now she says all legal aid can do is advise them about their rights. They can't help them navigate the immigration courts.
No more representation of any kind could be done, or at least wouldn't be paid for by the federal government.
Mass protests across the country over the weekend drew millions of demonstrators, many opposed to cutting health care and food assistance. A budget outline moving in Congress would likely cut Medicaid and CHIP by $800 billion over 10 years. Medicaid covers half of all births nationally, and the two programs together cover nearly two-thirds of rural children in states like New Mexico. And advocates are criticizing USDA reductions in key hunger programs, like the $1 billion slashed from a program that helps schools and food banks buy locally sourced nutrition. About one in six Oregon children face food insecurity. Fisherman Patrick Raleigh says he had been planning to sell some of the 90 truckloads the schools and food banks had planned to buy before the funding was frozen.
And then the ultimate value is when the students get the chance to eat the finest quality products the planet has to offer.
The USDA says the programs no longer accomplish the goals of the agency. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for We Decide, America at a Crossroads, from the Pacifica Network. This episode takes a coast-to-coast look at the national hands-off protests this past weekend. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, it will be in the 50s with rain throughout the night. Tomorrow's weather will be a high of 57 with a low of 45. Today in history, in 2022, Ketanji Brown Jackson is confirmed to the Supreme Court of the U.S., becoming the first black woman to do so. The quote of the day is from Justice Stephen Breyer, who said, quote, "What is the law? What is law supposed to do, seen as a whole? It is supposed to allow all people, to live together in a society where they have so many different views, so many different needs, to live together in a way that is more harmonious, that is better, so that they can work productively together," end quote.
Alaska Native cultural ambassadors prepare for the upcoming tourist season, despite the uncertainty caused by the Trump administration. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Forest Service staffing at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center in Juneau, Alaska, remains uncertain due to turmoil from the Trump administration's federal firings. but there will be 8 people working at the glacier in a different role as cultural ambassadors employed by the local tribe. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
At the Medicine Hall Glacier Visitor Center, cultural ambassadors are learning how to best represent Tlingit's stewardship and connections to the glacier to the roughly 1 million tourists slated to visit this summer. Sani Liana Wallace sets off down the walkway towards Steep Creek.
We'll never stop talking. Join the crowd.
We're talking about plants. So Lee, who's been here a while, is going to show me a plant that he wants us to work on. Oh, nice.
They're part of the group of ambassadors who will be at the glacier when tourists start arriving in less than 2 weeks. The Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska program started last year. As part of a co-stewardship agreement, the tribe formed with the U.S. Forest Service. It will allow people like Shak Dintach, Jonah Johnson, to teach visitors about Devil's Club, or as it's called in Tlingit, because there's more to it than meets the eye.
It looks like it's just a harmful plant, but it's really our medicine plant.
In February, a wave of federal firings left one remaining Forest Service staff member at the visitor center. In a typical summer, there are about a dozen on site. Some of the fired staff have been rehired, but there are rumors they may lose their jobs again. But while that's up in the air, the cultural ambassadors are moving forward with their plan to staff the Mendenhall Glacier Recreation Area. Lee Miller is returning for his second season. He says he thinks all the staff at the glacier will be spread thin this year. Miller says he loves representing the Occoquan and bringing the joy of the natural world to the visitors.
You can pass it on to them. You're coming in and you say, okay, I just saw a porcupine out on the meadow there. You know, just point it out to them and they'll ask you questions.
Miller's family has been here for thousands of years, but he'll be greeting people who are seeing the glacier for the first time.
Just interacting with them and watching them, you know, it's just, that made the whole season.
And the 2025 season begins April 14th. When the first ship arrives. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
A group of education leaders from tribal organizations testified at a U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs hearing last week against the dissolution of the U.S. Department of Education and for the protection of programs that support Native students. The hearing followed an executive order President Trump signed last month to close the department. Rosita Kahani-Worrell, president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, spoke about the persistent lack of education funding, especially in Alaska, given the state's fiscal situation.
Despite these challenges, we can confidently state that through our culture-based programs that we have integrated into schools with DOE funding, we have witnessed measurable educational achievement among Native students, as well as improvements in their social and emotional well-being.
Sydna Yellowfish is director of Indian education at Edmond Public Schools in Oklahoma. She says programs also help Native students who are homeless or in foster care.
These challenges such as suicide and substance abuse, most recent bullying and sexual assault that we have worked with our students, I feel like we are obligated to address these challenges and work with our students and our families as the best that we can.
Senator Lisa Murkowski co-led the oversight hearing. She says the department's programs help the government fulfill its trust responsibility. Murkowski says that one idea to work around the department closure would be to transfer the programs to other agencies and to administer funding through the states. However, Murkowski and several witnesses pointed out that such a transition could be detrimental to tribal sovereignty and lead to additional bureaucratic hurdles and delays. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Today is Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Women's Equal Pay Day. The day calls for AANHPI women's wages to catch up to what non-Hispanic white men made last year. As a group, AANHPI women make 83 cents on the dollar compared to white men. The disparities they face can be obscured by the model minority myth, which portrays Asian Americans as a universally successful bloc. In reality, AANHPI women are overrepresented in low-wage work, and they can face added hurdles to their economic mobility. That could include things like limited English proficiency, issues with work authorizations, and workplace discrimination. Sunyon Choi Morrow is the executive director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. She said, quote, over the course of a 40-year career, full-time, year-round AANHPI women workers can lose nearly $82,000 to the wage gap. This persistent inequity robs our communities of the opportunity to build wealth and thrive. We must strengthen the protections offered by the Equal Pay Act and advocate for better, more inclusive policies that support economic stability and opportunity for all." End quote. More equal pay days for other groups of women are still to come this year. Black Women's Equal Pay Day is July 10th, Latina Equal Pay Day is October 8th, and Native Women's Equal Pay Day is November 18th.
Multnomah County Commissioners could adopt new rules to change the powers of the county chair. Commissioners Julia Brim Edwards, Vince Jones Dixon, and Megan Moyer want to temper the chair's power and reform how the commission operates. New potential rules would let county commissioners add an item to the agenda. Right now, only the chair can add something to the agenda. That's been criticized before as potentially illegal. Possible rules also include requiring a majority vote to end or cancel public meetings, require agendas to be posted a week before a meeting, and make meetings more accessible. These come from recommendations from former Portland auditor Mary Hull Caballero. So far, Chair Jessica Vega Pedersen is open to the proposed changes. She told Oregon Live in a statement, quote, "The board's ability to work together and communicate effectively and transparently will be increased with updated board rules and practices, and that's something the public should applaud," end quote. Councillor Shannon Singleton and Brim Edwards presented draft rules to track which groups are lobbying county officials last month. Currently, none of Oregon's most populous county do this. Proposed changes will be discussed at the Multnomah County Commission meeting on Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Washington Governor Bob Ferguson is at a crossroads with lawmakers over how to approach the state's revenue shortfall. Advocates for working people say the state's wealthiest residents and corporations need to start paying their fair share of taxes. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Washington lawmakers and Governor Ferguson disagree about how to address the state's $16 billion revenue shortfall. The House and Senate have both passed budgets which would tax wealthy residents and corporations in order to balance the budget. In contrast, Governor Ferguson's plan cuts social programs and furloughs employees to save the state $7 billion. Jeffrey Gustavison is with Firelands Workers United, an advocacy group for rural Washingtonians. He says he supports lawmakers' efforts to make the tax system more fair.
They're saying we should support working people and we're going to unlock new sources of money by increasing taxes on giant corporations and some of the wealthiest human beings in the face of the planet.
As budget negotiations move forward, Governor Ferguson called relying on untested taxes irresponsible. Lawmakers have until April 27th to finalize a budget acceptable to the governor. David Henson is a retired veteran and volunteer for Firelands. He highlights what's known as the tax on Wall Street, which would apply to people who own stocks and bonds worth over $50 million. Democrats say it would generate about $4 billion a year for the state.
But it only affects 4,300 people in the state of Washington. They only pay 4%, where we're paying on average 14% of our income on taxes. I don't think it's robbery.
Governor Ferguson says his budget does not include reductions to vital services, but counters Gustavison, the governor's definition of vital is narrow. He says a 6% cut from all state agencies will harm many services Washington residents rely on, including healthcare, housing, and transit.
There's a very clear message, I think, from the public right now that they support public programs and they support funding those public programs with fair taxes.
Democratic lawmakers say their proposed taxes would generate $17 billion over 2 years, bringing the state out of the red. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Public utility commissions have a lot of power when it comes to climate. Few people know about them, but their impact is huge. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. People who care about climate change may be missing an opportunity to influence state and local energy policies. Every state has a public utility commission, made up of a small number of people who are either appointed by the state government or elected by voters. These groups are often responsible for setting the price of electricity, permitting new power plants, planning for renewable energy, and making decisions about the future of the grid. But few consumers know who these commissioners are or what they do.
I kept on coming back to this question. How are these bodies so important, yet even within the energy space, even within the climate space, a lot of people hadn't really heard of them or were thinking about them?
Charles Hua is the founder of the nonprofit Power Lines. His group encourages people to look up who sits on their state's public utility commission, find groups who are engaging with them, and make their voices heard.
I think it's incumbent on all of us to have some level of awareness of these decision makers so that we can make sure that they're ultimately held accountable to the public interest and making sure that they are doing everything that they can to advance a more affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system for us all.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 7th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Alan Niven, Lexis Ponce, and Onyx. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Farah Siddiqui, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Lexis Ponce. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for We Decide, America at the Crossroads from the Pacifica Network.